Good morning. Thanks for coming to our Lou Jones breakfast here in July. It's a light month because of vacations, and I think some people still think it's Summerfest is on. It's actually over, but we're really pleased to have Anton Nicolai talk about student loans. It's a hot topic, of course, in bankruptcy. We're in New Digs in Milwaukee. We're in room 190 now, and we hope that the video, if anything, is going to be enhanced because we have the HD going and stuff like that. So we will be here going forward, hopefully filling the room a little bit more, although I'm sure we'll have some stragglers straggling in. Let me tell you about what we have coming up. Next month on August 14th, Tim Nettesheim is going to be here presenting on tax consequences for LLC members after bankruptcy. This is a topic that's been discussed on the listserv, and so I'm sure you want to be here and hear what he's got to say about that. Then in September, on September 11th, Barb Fritchell, who's our federal court librarian, Melissa Blair, my law clerk, Stephanie Webb, Judge Shapiro's law clerk, are going to present on effective legal research. So, you know, all the new services available and what are some great tips available for doing bankruptcy research. So please mark your calendars and come on back August 14th for Tim Nettesheim on the tax consequences of LLCs, and September 11th on effective legal research. If you can't make it, we understand, everybody's busy. We are now, in addition to putting the outlines on our website under the Lou Jones Breakfast tab, we're also putting the audio recordings. So I'm not sure, as somebody suggested, it's like a podcast that you could listen to in your car, but if you want to listen to the recording that goes along with the outline, you're welcome to do that by going to the website under the Lou Jones Breakfast tab. Again, thanks everybody for coming. I'm going to turn it over to Anton Nicolai on student loans and bankruptcy. Thanks, Anton.
Thank you, Judge. I think student loans is a particularly interesting topic right now for several reasons. And one thing I'd like to cite is a report released by the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys, or NACBA, back in February, which highlights the growing problem that is student loans. There's some very troubling statistics in this report. First, which I found shocking, Americans now owe more on student loans than on credit cards. The amount of student borrowing crossed the $100 billion threshold for the first time in 2010, and total outstanding loans exceeded $1 trillion for the first time last year. Signs also indicate that student loan debt is increasing. The report cites a study which shows that college seniors who graduated with student loans in 2010 owed an average of $25,250, up 5% from just the previous year. And it's not only for students, this problem is also prevalent for parents as well, not only in co-signing situations, but for parent-student loans too, which we'll talk about later. But loans to parents for college education for their children have jumped 75% since the 2005-06 academic year. Not only are loans themselves increasing, but defaults are as well. Another statistic they cite found that of the class of 2005 borrowers who began repayments the year they graduated, one analysis found that 25% became delinquent at some point and 15% defaulted. So these problems are getting worse. And anecdotally, I can speak to seeing more and more clients in our office in our consumer bankruptcy practice who have student loan problems. It doesn't seem to be going away, and it seems to be increasing. And one of the things I want to talk about is options that debtors have, not just in the bankruptcy context, but in non-bankruptcy context as well. I think a lot of debtors come to us with the mistaken impression that there's nothing that they can do for student loan debt. While it's true, which we'll talk about, discharging student loan debt is very limited, there are other options available to consumer debtors to deal with student loans, both in bankruptcy and beyond bankruptcy. So I think it's important to understand all of these issues so you can really fully, properly advise a consumer debtor as to how to really get their fresh start and move forward and grow. So the first section of the outline deals with student loans in bankruptcy and how student loans are affected by consumer bankruptcy proceedings. A lot of this is well known to everybody here in this room, rules about discharge and such, but I think it's important to kind of highlight some of the basics here. First and foremost, when a consumer debtor files for a bankruptcy, the automatic stay goes into place, and that does cover federal and private student loans. So once a bankruptcy is filed, student loan creditors can no longer take collection efforts against consumer debtors while the case is active and while the stay is in place. That can be particularly helpful for debtors on a short-term basis to deal with things like administrative wage garnishments and other particularly nasty collection efforts that can be employed by private and federal student loan creditors. So that can be an important short-term fix for your average consumer debtor. But the discharge of student loans is very limited. Under Section 523A8 of the code, unless a debtor can show undue hardship, federal and student loans are not dischargeable. Prior to the 2005 amendments, this did not extend to private student loans, but now it does. So whether a student loan is a federal loan or a private loan, its discharge is limited by 523A8. Now, that code section does provide for discharge of student loans if the debtor can demonstrate undue hardship. That is a pretty high test to meet. It's tough to meet that because, as case law points out, we're not looking at ordinary hardship or garden variety hardship. We're looking at undue hardship, and the test for that is pretty high. The Seventh Circuit has adopted the three-prong test from the Brunner case, which I have cited in the materials. In order to demonstrate that student loans are dischargeable, the debtor's got to bring an adversary proceeding inside their bankruptcy action and seek a declaratory judgment that these student loans are dischargeable. Now, to do that, they've got to meet this three-part Brunner test, which is as follows. First part of the test, the debtor has to demonstrate that they cannot maintain, based on their current income and expenses, a minimal standard of living for him or herself and his or her dependents if they're forced to repay the loan. The second part of the test, they have to show additional circumstances indicating that this current state of affairs is likely to persist for a significant portion of the repayment period. And the third prong, the debtor has to show that he or she has made a good faith effort to repay the loans already. The first part of the test, I mean, a lot of debtors can meet based upon their budget. I mean, if you demonstrate that your current level of income isn't enough to support you, your dependents, and repay the loans, you can meet that test. But the problem for a lot of debtors comes in with that second prong, which some courts have called the certainty of hopelessness test. And the test isn't to demonstrate that the debtor's future holds an absolute certainty of hopelessness, and I'm citing In re Nelson here, but rather they have to show that additional circumstances which make it reasonably certain that the debtor's circumstances are unlikely to improve. So the circumstances right now don't allow for payment of these student loans and a minimal standard of living. And not only do they not do that right now, it's reasonably certain that in the future it's not going to be that way either. So it's a tricky test to meet. And the third prong has tripped up debtors in some cases as well, is that prior to establishing undue hardship, the debtor has to show that they made good faith efforts to repay the loans. Have any payments been made on the loans? Have they made any efforts whatsoever to try some of the somewhat generous federal loan repayment plans that are out there, which we'll talk about later? Some type of showing that they've made good faith efforts is required. What that really boils down to then for most consumer debtors is that discharge isn't usually an option for most consumer debtors. So if discharge isn't an option, they have to look beyond bankruptcy to some of the other avenues for dealing with these debts going forward if they ever want to be free of their student loan obligation. Now, beyond the discharge discussion, there is some interesting case law that has to do with student loan treatment in Chapter 13 bankruptcies, which are interesting to discuss. One of them, which is kind of a hot topic right now, is separately classifying student loans from other general unsecured creditors. Now, it's important to start by talking about, by default, how is a student loan treated in a bank in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy proceeding? By default, it's treated as a general unsecured non-priority claim. It doesn't have priority status under the code. It's certainly not secured. So it's lumped in with the debtor's other unsecured debts, credit cards, medical bills, personal loans, etc. And the student loan creditors will receive the same percentage or rate of distribution as all those other general unsecured creditors over the course of a Chapter 13 case. So obviously, this depends on the individual case here as to how much a student loan creditor is set to receive in a Chapter 13. Certainly, there are some Chapter 13 plans of reorganization which provide for full payment of unsecured claims. And in that scenario, a student loan creditor has nothing to worry about. They're going to get paid. But many Chapter 13 plans provide for a very small rate of distribution to unsecured creditors. Now, in some scenarios, a debtor can propose to separately classify student loan creditors from other general unsecured creditors, and there's reasons that they'd want to do that. Debtors' reasons for doing that would be to attempt to maximize plan payments toward non-dischargeable debt, also to avoid accrual of post-filing interest on those student loans. Because let's look at what happens to a debtor with student loans lumped in with the other unsecured creditors over the course of a plan. What will likely happen is the amount of plan funds that gets paid to those student loan creditors over the course of a 3 to 5 year plan isn't going to be enough to cover all regularly due payments contractually for that debtor over the course of the plan, which will likely trigger default interest rates, and all sorts of other problems once the stay expires at the end of the repayment plan. So debtor files a Chapter 13, gets a discharge, and all the student loan creditors now can reawaken, can unfreeze, and can continue all of their collection efforts again. And by the way, debtor, you're now in default, because you haven't made a payment in 3 to 5 years. And by the way, the default interest rates now apply. So in certain scenarios, it makes sense for a Chapter 13 debtor to propose that separate classification. And looking to the code, there's a couple conflicting provisions in the code which have been litigated on both a national and local level. Most debtors argue for separate classification based on 1322b5. That provides that a debtor may maintain payments on any unsecured claim on which the last payment is due after the due date of the final plan payment. Now, when it comes to student loans, we'll talk a little bit more about repayment plan options for federal student loans later, but by default, federal student loan repayment is a 10-year term. And in many cases, that term is extended to 25 years. So most debtors can demonstrate that the last due date on their student loan is far beyond the last due date in their Chapter 13 plan, whether it's a 3, 4, or 5 year plan. But 1322b5 does seem to conflict with 1322b1, which provides that while a debtor may designate a class of unsecured claims, that debtor may not discriminate unfairly against any class so designated. So that tends to be the argument the other way, in that separately classifying student loans is unfairly discriminatory against the other general unsecured creditors. So most of the cases seem to turn on the conflict between B5 and B1, and a lot of the cases reviewed nationally also turn on that unfairness standard. Is it fair? Certainly you can discriminate, but is that discrimination fair or not? And I cited some cases in the outline that are worth reviewing, some local cases that talk about this conflict, and there does seem to be kind of a split in this district. So it's tricky as to whether or not you decide as debtor's counsel to pursue this type of classification or not. I think a lot of it depends on the case. It's very fact-specific. What's the situation of the debtor? What's their budget? What's their income? What's the total picture here? That's where I think that the Edmonds case is interesting, and that's where Judge Shapiro actually denied the separate classification, seemingly looking at that individual case and that individual set of facts. So that's an interesting one to read. Also, the In re Johnson case from Judge Kelly, where it was allowed but also seemed very fact-dependent. But there is a practice note here, which I've run into, on cases where we've tried to separately classify student loans, is that by default, when a bankruptcy is filed and the Department of Education gets that notice that the bankruptcy has been filed, they will automatically take all student loans out of repayment status. That's a problem if your debtor is proposing to maintain current payments, because if they're out of repayment status, they move to delinquency and eventually to default. So if you do propose a plan, and indeed you have that plan approved where the student loans are going to be paid for and maintained under their contractually required payments, you've got to call the Department of Ed. And it may take several phone calls, and it's tough to find the right person. But you want to ensure that those federal loans are moved back to repayment status, so payments made during the plan count, and they can count for different types of repayment programs, which we'll talk about later, like public service loan forgiveness or income-based repayment. So it's very important that everybody's on the same page with what you're trying to do.
Does talking to their lawyers help, Anton? I know it's always Attorney Goodinger, isn't it, from Eau Claire, who's representing the student loan creditors that I see. Can you talk to him?
That's a good place to start, too, but sometimes it still takes many, many calls to many, many parties. Because a lot of times if the debt's already in default, it's already been transferred to a third-party debt collector, and now you have them involved as well, and trying to get everybody on the same page can be difficult. But eventually, if you call enough people, I always operate under the presumption that I'll just call everybody and make sure that, you know, creditors, counsel, Department of Ed, any collection agency, that everybody's on the same page with what the debtor's trying to do before we proceed. Because the last thing you want is 2 years later to find out that that wasn't the case. That could create some problems for your debtor with their student loans. Now, there are some issues for co-debtors as well for these student loans. A lot of these student loans are co-signed by parents or by relatives or friends, and those co-signers are obviously 100% liable to those loans just as the students are. Student loans are consumer debts, so if a debtor files a Chapter 13, the co-signer does get the benefit of the co-debtor stay. So while that 13 is going on, mom and dad don't have to worry about being pursued by student loan creditors, at least while the student is in the Chapter 13. And that would go vice versa. If a parent were to file the Chapter 13, the student wouldn't have to worry about collection efforts for a while. That's very different with private loans. And we'll talk a little bit more about co-signers with private loans later. But it's important to know, first, you know, what type of debts these debtors have. Are they federal student loans? Are they private student loans? Are there co-signers? Are they in default? Are they delinquent? Have they ever made a payment? Has the payment even come due yet? To really advise somebody as to their options, you've really got to understand the whole picture. You know, first and foremost, there's a huge distinction between federal student loans and private student loans. And from a debtor's perspective, a good way to look at the difference is to look at the remedies involved for creditors in the event of default. If we look at federal loans, they're backed by the U.S. government. Obviously, that's what makes them federal loans. And in the event of default, they have a wide range of remedies available to them to collect from the debtor. Once in default, these federal loans are going to go right back to the Department of Education, and the collection efforts will proceed from there. But there are, when you look at federal loans, there are several different types of federal loans. And a great resource to check if you're representing a debtor with student loans is, I cite the website in the materials, it's the National Student Loan Data System. It's a website you can go to, and you punch in the debtor's Social Security number, first two letters of their last name, and usually if a debtor has student loans, they have a PIN number. This website will request that PIN number, which they use to fill out their financial aid applications, like a FAFSA form, and you can access through that system a full and complete list of all federal student loans that debtor has, and has had. So it's going to show all current student loans that are out there, federal, what types they are, whether they're Perkins or Stafford, and we'll talk about those types. And it'll show closed accounts, accounts that have been paid in full, or accounts that have been consolidated. That's another interesting aspect of these student loans. And it helps because a lot of times debtors come into the office and have no idea the nature of their student loans. They don't know if they're federal loans, they don't know if they're private loans, they don't know what type of federal loans they are, and using whatever resource you can to ascertain these factors and characteristics of the loans are incredibly helpful, and I really like this National Student Loan Data System because immediately I have a complete grasp on the federal loan picture, at least in terms of what loans are out there, what the amounts are, etc. Doesn't tell me whether they're delinquent or whether they're in default, but I do have some data to start working with when we start to put together some type of plan for them. Now, there are different types of federal student loans, and they all have different characteristics, and it's good to understand what type of loan you're dealing with. Now, the most common type of federal loan you'll see is called a Stafford loan. It's offered to undergraduate and graduate students. You'll see both subsidized Stafford loans, which are need-based, where interest is paid for by the government while the student's going through their educational program. And you'll also see unsubsidized Stafford loans, which are not need-based, and where interest starts accruing right away once the student takes out the loan. So these are the most common federal loans you'll see. You'll also run across PLUS loans, and there's different types of PLUS loans out there. First type of PLUS loan is a parent PLUS loan, and these are federal loans offered to parents of students in undergraduate programs. What a lot of undergraduate students face is they're offered federal Stafford loans to pay for their undergraduate studies, but there's caps on those federal Stafford loans. So a lot of times, the amount that they're able to borrow through the Stafford loans is not enough. And the caps for Stafford loans can change as the student moves through the undergraduate program. But to make up that difference, if there's not enough money available with the Stafford loans to actually pay for their education, they can make up that difference through the use of some other loans. This is where we see a lot of private loans. Also where we see some of these parent PLUS loans. These are loans taken out by parents for students in undergraduate programs to cover costs that the Stafford loans don't cover. Parent PLUS loans are a little funny because they have different repayment plan options than general Stafford loans, which we'll talk about a little bit later. A couple years ago, graduate PLUS loans were introduced, and these are loans for graduate students that are loaned directly to the student, there's no parent involved, to pay for educational costs that exceed the level that a student can take in Stafford loans. So you see these a lot with graduate students, professional students, law students. I know all about Grad PLUS loans, and they're important to know what repayment options they have. Now, for students, there is a cap as to how much they can borrow in Stafford loans. And it's a cap that applies to all undergraduate studies and graduate studies. And I don't have the exact number in front of me, but the lifetime cap is somewhere around $120,000 to $150,000 of loans that they can borrow. Once you hit that number, that's it. Whether you're going back to more school, whether you're changing careers, you can no longer take out Stafford loans anymore, which is where these Grad PLUS loans come in, because Grad PLUS loans have no lifetime caps. You can take as many Grad PLUS loans as you want, and they are federal loans, and they do have the benefit of federal loan repayment plans. So you'll run across the Grad PLUS loans with graduates and professional students. Perkins loans are a little more rare, and they're also kind of a unique animal because they're originated by schools themselves. So the schools handle the collection and a lot of the administration of these loans. And also, again, like with the Parent PLUS, it's good to understand that some of the repayment options with Perkins loans aren't quite the same as the more common Stafford loans. Now, if you look at, briefly on private loans, they're very different to the federal loans, and their collection remedies are not nearly as expansive as federal loans. So a couple aspects with the private loans. First, while statutes of limitation do not apply to federal student loans can, you know, chase debtors to the grave, they do apply to private loans. Private loans do not have access to some of the more expansive collection options that federal loans do. For example, I mean, they can only be enforced through judicial mechanisms under relevant state law. So no administrative wage garnishment for private loans. They want to garnish wages, they've got to sue and get a judgment in state court and start a garnishment action. To analogize, if you're a private student loan creditor, you basically have the same collection options as a credit card. You can't do anything else beyond that. Nothing special for them. But federal student loans have a lot more interesting options. If a student defaults on federal loans, a couple things can happen. First, they're going to be faced with default interest rates, which can be very high, and much higher than some of the more reasonable interest rates that you'll see on the initial student loans. They're higher now than they used to be, but some of the older loans you'll see have very, very small interest rates. What else can the Department of Education do? They can intercept tax refunds. They can offset Social Security, and that there's some limitations there, but they're able to do that. After they send a 30-day warning letter, they can start an administrative wage garnishment. They don't require a state court order, and they are going to result in 15% of disposable pay being garnished. Now, another interesting aspect is that these administrative wage garnishments for federal loans are going to trump any other garnishments that are out there. So they get paid first before any other state court judgments do. So they have a lot of very special treatment with what they can do to these students that default. Now, if you look at the lifeline of a student loan from a federal student loan perspective, once the loan's taken out, we assume that the student is in school and working through their program. While they're in school, they're able to defer payments on all student loans as long as they're enrolled on at least a part-time basis. So there's different definitions for part-time depending on the program that they're in terms of credit load. But if you can demonstrate that you're in school and your school can demonstrate that and state that, these loans are going to stay in deferment. Now, once you graduate or drop out, you're no longer in school, you're going to soon enter repayment status, but you do get a six-month grace period on these federal student loans before they automatically jump into repayment. So you get 6 months to kind of catch your breath, find a job, and figure something out. Otherwise, the first payment's going to be due right away. There are some deferments available to students once they enter repayment status. An important one is the economic hardship deferment, which is available for federal student loans. So if you're unemployed or you enter into a period of economic hardship where you can't afford to make the student loan payments anymore, you can apply for a deferment of those student loans. And that deferment can go up to 36 months. But students only get economic hardship deferment for 36 months total over the life of the loan. So if you take 6 months 1 year and 6 months the next, those months count towards your lifetime loan cap of 36. And once you hit 36 months deferment already taken, you can't take any more. So it's important when looking at, you know, jumping into economic hardship deferment, you got to remember that, you know, if you only get 36. So if you take it now, be wary and plan and be strategic as to when you take it. Now, once a student stops making payments, they don't enter into default right away. Once they miss a payment, they move into what's called delinquency status under these federal loans. And delinquency status applies if the debtor is somewhere between 1 and 270 days late. So in that 270 days isn't a hard and fast rule, but it's around 270 where as long as you haven't exceeded that 270-day late barrier, you're not yet in default, which is important. Because once a student gets into default, it's very hard to get back out. So if you're talking with a consumer debtor and they tell you they have some federal student loans and you're looking at bankruptcy and non-bankruptcy options, it's important to know, I mean, 9 times out of 10, they probably have stopped making payments, but how long have they stopped making payments? I always ask, you know, when's the last time you made a payment? How many payments have you missed? Because it's important to know whether they're in default or not. There's ways to get them out of default, but it's tricky, and it's not anything guaranteed. And some of the ways out of default are limited. You can do them once, but that's it. So if they're only delinquent yet, we can try to find a way to get that loan caught up. You don't go into default, your credit's not hurt, and you can move forward, and hopefully in a reasonable repayment plan. There is something with these federal loans called rehabilitation. If these federal student loans go into default status, once during the life of the loan, the student has the right to rehabilitate and get out of default status. But that's it. They can only do it once. So and most student debtors don't understand that this option's out there once they go into default, but it's there, and it's a very helpful tool to use, you know, whether you're not in bankruptcy at all or whether you're post-bankruptcy and you're trying to clean up this debtor's picture and really get them their fresh start, you can use this rehabilitation tool to get out of default and start making payments again. So once you have a debtor in default, to rehabilitate, they're required to make 9 full contractual payments within a 10-month time frame. They're able to do that, and they even get one month out. It's not 10 payments in 10 months. They even get that flexibility. If you make 9 payments in 10 months, you can exit default status and go back into a repayment plan, sometimes a more affordable repayment plan, and start, you know, first you're going to stop the negative credit reporting issues. They're not going to have credit score problems, and they can be allowed to join one of those very beneficial federal student loan repayment programs, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But they only get this option once. So the analysis for federal student loans is, you know, are you delinquent? If so, how much? When's the last time you made the payment? Have you entered default yet? If you have entered default, have you rehabilitated before or have you not? And you can use once you look at those factors, you can figure out how are we going to get this debtor onto an affordable repayment plan for this non-dischargeable debt. So that's an important thing to look at. Now, for some students, they can take advantage of administrative or statutory discharge of student loan debt. These are very limited situations, but there are some situations where, by statute, a debtor can discharge these student loan obligations. And they're very, the outline cites a couple of them. They're pretty rare, and I don't see them very often at all. But sometimes you see these situations, and administrative discharge is a lot easier than bankruptcy discharge with the undue hardship showing. One example is school closure. If a student's attending an institution and that institution closes, and there are some timelines here where a student has to be enrolled at that institution for a certain period of time, but assuming that they meet those timing requirements, if that school closes, that debtor can apply for statutory discharge of any student loans they took out while at that school. I've seen some cases not the cases that I've handled, but the other people have handled, where some of these other ones come into play, like false certification, where maybe a school really wants to get a particular student to enroll. So even though the student isn't eligible for student loans, that school will go ahead and make a false certification that that student is eligible for student loans. That happens. It's not common. But if that were to happen, there is an administrative discharge available for that student to get out of those student loans. There is a disability administrative discharge, and it's a completely different standard than undue hardship. It's a different standard than used for Social Security disability. But the general rule is if you can show that that person is totally and permanently disabled and not be able to be employed in any capacity whatsoever, you can look at that disability discharge administratively and save time and save the hassle of going through a bankruptcy proceeding and get rid of those student loans. But again, that standard is very high, just like undue hardship. It's not a disability standard if this person can basically work any job whatsoever, you're not going to get an administrative disability discharge. You also do need medical evidence, you need doctor's notes. There's lots of stuff that you have to do if you're going to apply for that. But it's out there. A lot of debtors don't know that there are these administrative discharge options in these limited scenarios, but it's good for them to know. But most of the time, what we see in our consumer debtor practice is debtors who can't discharge student loans. So they don't meet the requirements of statutory discharge. They can't meet the undue hardship test under Brunner. So they can't file an adversary to establish that their student loans are discharged in a bankruptcy. So what do? Well, that's when we look at getting them in to reasonable repayment plans so that they have options and they have a way to pay back the student loans affordably, and to do so without impacting their credit negatively. And there are some debt forgiveness programs with some of these student loans. So as far as repayment plans, they are different for federal student loans and private student loans, but let's talk about federal student loan repayment. So once a student comes out of in-school deferment, they get their six-month grace period, the next step is the first plan that they enter for federal student loans is the standard repayment plan. This plan is fixed payments for 10 years, starting point for everybody. And for a lot of students, based upon the amount of debt that they have, if you do the math, that payment is pretty hefty, especially for maybe law school graduates or somebody else, professional school graduates, where the student loan debt load they took on is substantial. To amortize that over a 10-year term at equal payments is not going to be something feasible, especially for a student right out of school, early on in their career. The 10-year plan is rarely something that's feasible. There are graduated repayment plans where you stick with a 10-year repayment term, but you start with lower interest-only payments for the first 2 years, and then every 2 years thereafter, you can increase your payments. But remember that for the standard graduated repayment system, you're still on the 10-year repayment plan. Now, because 10 years is laughable for some students with their debt loads, federal student loans do offer extended repayment plans as well. So if debtors have in excess of $60,000 in federal student loan debt, they can apply for extended repayment, where they get a 25-year repayment term for their student loans. And they've got a couple of options once they're in extended repayment. They can make fixed monthly equal payments for 25 years, or they can also utilize a similar graduated repayment plan. It's similar to the 10-year graduated, except now we start, again, 2 years interest only, and then increase every 2 years thereafter. So that way, you can start low, and assuming that your income is going to increase over time, which may or may not be an appropriate assumption, the graduated payments can work. Now, some of these other payment plans for federal student loans offer student loan or student debtors the ability to get some of their federal student loan debt forgiven. And this is a huge tool that should be utilized by more people. Income Contingent Repayment, or ICR, is an older plan. It's the first debt forgiveness plan that was introduced. And what that plan looks at is a formula, which is pretty extensive, and I didn't want to waste time in the outline going through that formula. But it's a formula based on the student's income and their student loan balance. So the higher the balance, the higher your payment's going to be. It's not just set on income. But you'll set a monthly payment, and you'll change your payment obligations each year for 25 years. And at the end of that 25-year period, you can get the balance on the student loans forgiven. The problem with income contingent repayment is how the monthly payment is tied to the student loan balance. Especially for students with higher debt loads, their income doesn't allow for much repayment at all, but through the ICR formula, they are penalized for the amount of debt that they have. So income contingent repayment was designed to be a more realistic payment option for debtors, but for high debt load students, it just doesn't work, which is why back in 2009, income-based repayment was introduced. I have this starred because in most cases, if you have debtors with federal student loans, this is the best payment plan available to them if they cannot meet their normal either 10-year repayment plan payment or 25-year repayment plan payment. Income-based repayment is based solely on a student's income. So they don't look at debt load. They don't look at anything else. They just look at the income of the student. And based upon the income, we use a formula to determine what their monthly payment obligation is going to be. To qualify for income-based repayment, most students who need it are going to qualify because all that they have to show is that the payment under the income-based repayment plan formula is less than what their monthly payment obligation would be under the standard 10-year equal monthly payment plan. And for any high debt load student, that's going to be pretty easy to show, because as we talked about, the 10-year equal repayment can be pretty high. So as long as you, under the formula, your payment's less than what you'd be paying in a standard plan, you qualify for income-based repayment. How do they look at income? They look at your taxes, and they look at your adjusted gross income on the most recently filed tax return. And a couple points, if you have married debtors, if the debtor's married and the debtor and his or her spouse file joint tax returns, the income-based repayment formula is going to look at total household income. If the debtor is married, but he or she files separate, married filed separately returns, then IBR is just going to look at that student debtor's income individually. So, and I've seen situations where families take advantage of this scenario, where maybe you have a couple who's filed joint returns forever, but under income-based repayment, maybe one spouse makes a lot more than the other. There are scenarios where sometimes it makes sense to do some planning and look into doing married filing separately. And there are some tax implications there, but I've had cases where, you know, when you run the math, they're going to save more by doing separate returns and utilizing income-based repayment than they are filing jointly. So that's a case-by-case analysis, but it's something to watch out for. Now, the other thing that students are required to do with income-based repayment is submit copies of their tax returns to the Department of Education and their student loan servicer every year that they are in income-based repayment. So every year they've got to fill out an application and attach their tax information, and every year the payment's going to be recalculated based on AGI. Now, there's also a separate alternative application if AGI isn't a true representation of what your income is going to be going forward. So let's say that I file for income-based repayment now, and all of a sudden I become unemployed, and you look at my AGI from last year, it shows a significant level of employment income. I can fill out the alternative application for IBR and attach some proof of what my current income is now. Maybe it's only unemployment. And they can use an alternative formula to calculate what these student debtors are going to have to pay over the next year. But regardless of how you fill out the application, you've got to do that application once a year, every year. If you don't, you're going to fall out of the income-based repayment program and go right back to standard repayment, which is not where a lot of people want to be. If that happens and you don't follow the income-based repayment requirements, you fall back into standard repayment, it's tough to get back into income-based repayment. So, and they have done a better job at designing the forms. When income-based repayment started in 2009, I think it was June or July 1st, 2009, the forms were pretty confusing. I know, I filled them out, and they weren't very easy for most people to understand. They were tricky for lawyers to understand, let alone non-lawyers. The government has done a better job of simplifying these. And I know the White House recently announced that they were trying to develop a program where starting this fall, and I don't know what the timeline is here, but starting this fall, students could go online and fill out a very simple income-based repayment application online and not have to fill out all the paperwork. Would probably be beneficial for a lot of people who've struggled with the forms in the past. That online option hasn't debuted yet, so who knows what it's going to look like. But if I put somebody on income-based repayment after a bankruptcy, you know, you got to tell them, you got to fill this stuff out every year, otherwise you're going to fall out of IBR and you're going to be right back where you were before all this started. So IBR, staying on top of IBR is crucial. Now, how do you calculate what the monthly payment is? Well, what IBR looks at, remember, it's solely based on the income and not based at all upon any other factors. So what the formula is in a nutshell is they take a look at the household size of the student who's applying for income-based repayment, and they look at the poverty line for that household size. Now, you take 150% of the poverty line, and that level of income isn't touched by income-based repayment. But any dollar you make over and above 150% of the poverty line for your household size, any dollar above that is going to go calculate toward what your monthly payment obligation is. They define income over and above 150% of the poverty line as discretionary income. And the formula says we're going to take 15% of your discretionary income to apply towards your federal student loan debt. If you look at, I had a sample calculation in the outline, and, you know, for a family of three whose household income is $50,000, under this sample, they'd be paying $267 a month, which is reasonable. Now, imagine if in that example, the debtor had maybe well over $100,000 of student loan debt. Without income-based repayment, even on a 25-year graduated payment plan, they're going to be looking at payments well over and above $267 a month. That's why this is such a powerful tool, because you can get a payment that's affordable and stick with it. and it will track with that student as their income increases or decreases over time. Under income-based repayment, your payment can be zero. If your income is less than 150% of the poverty line, under the formula, you have $0 of discretionary income. So if you're unemployed and you're on income-based repayment, do a zero payment. You can apply and show proof of unemployment and drop your federal student loan payment down to zero. So I've told people in the past, don't jump to economic hardship deferment because you only get 36 months of that. And why do that if under income-based repayment, during a period of unemployment, you can drop your payment to zero? And you can stay at a zero payment as long as you remain unemployed. And once you're employed again, you can amend your income-based repayment application and get the payment back up again to, you know, tied to your income. But another key feature of the income-based repayment is it's a 25-year term for most students. If you're on the plan for 25 years, at the end of the repayment plan, any remaining balance is going to be forgiven. So all you've got to do is make 25 years of payments based on your income over 25 years, and then the balance is forgiven. That's an incredibly valuable tool, especially for high student loan debt individuals who maybe aren't as employable as they thought, or maybe they're not earning as much as they thought in this economy, and based upon their projected lifetime earnings, they would never be able to repay 100% of the student loans that they took out. You know, the other factor here is with tuition increasing and school costs increasing, and it's not going down. So with school becoming more and more expensive, income-based repayment is probably going to be utilized by a lot more people. It's still not that utilized, the program. A part of it has to do with consumer knowledge of the program. Part of it has to do with the complication of the forms. So hopefully with improved forms and more communication, more people will utilize it. Because it's, like we said, you can forgive debt without a statutory discharge and without a bankruptcy discharge. Couple notes on the forgiveness of debt. It is taxable, something to worry about, but let's worry about that 25 years from now. I'm not going to worry about that now, no matter how concerned my debtor is about that now. Let's pick our battles, and let's cross that bridge when we get there. But for now, you can stay in control your monthly payments while you're in this income-based repayment plan. Yep. Okay.
Is it a problem with IBR that you can't get it in if you're in default?
If you're in default, you can't get into IBR.
How many of our clients aren't, or at the end of 5 years in a Chapter 13 plan, aren't? I mean, that becomes the problem. Yes, it's a great program, and income contingent repayment is a great program, but if we're in default, there's no way out, because we can't afford the payment that they want on the 10-year plan, and we have to make 9 out of 10 of those. It's the chicken and the egg. You can't get out of default without using the plan in some way, shape, or form, but then we get, I mean, nationally mostly, I mean, I know we have to split in our court, but it's unfair discrimination to get them out of default with the plan, and you can't come up with 9 payments 5 years down the line. So all these programs are really great, but you can't use any of them.
That's a valid criticism. I mean, when I've had people, you do have the rehabilitation that Mike mentioned, but you have to make 9 payments in 10 months, and that's not 9 IBR payments, that's 9 standard repayments. So that could be a very substantial figure. I've had people try to borrow money from friends, relatives, family members, anybody, to get them, I mean, find the money someplace to make 9 payments out of 10 months so you can get into income-based repayment, but that's a huge problem.
Well, I mean, that's what I always had, because whenever you try to go in and argue this person's disabled and non-disability action, you get the government saying, well, we have these great programs. Yes, if I can come up with 9 payments on social on SSI at $600 a month and feed my 3 kids, but you aren't ever going to get there.
Which is a very legitimate and real concern with income-based repayment, is it's not available to enough people right now. And maybe I'll get up my soapbox a little bit, but I do think that income-based repayment should be expanded to make it easier to get into for people who are already in default, maybe coming out of a 5-year Chapter 13 where the debts weren't separately classified, and now they're in huge default, and they can't afford to employ the rehabilitation method to get out of default, there should be a better access to income-based repayment. It's one thing to have this program, but it should be made more available. And I hope that's something that's looked at in the future and addressed. It also applies to people who drop out of income-based repayment for whatever reason. To get back in, it's exceedingly difficult. So in many respects, it should be made available to more people, and that's a very valid criticism of the plan. But if you have somebody who's not in default and you can get them into income-based repayment, stay there as long as you can, get the debt forgiveness, and move on from there. But a lot of times if you're in default and you can't make 9 payments in 10 months and rehabilitate, or maybe you've already rehabilitated because you only get that once, then there's not a lot of options for you, and that's a real problem. Now you're back to collection of facing all their collection remedies for the full 10-year equal monthly payments that are there, and that's just not feasible for a lot of debtors.
So. Very happy note to end. Thank you, Anton. That was a really those here in Milwaukee, please sign in for your CLE credit. You guys in the video locations, get your names and info into Paula, and we'll submit your for your CLE credit. Come back in August for tax implications on LLCs going bankrupt, and then in September for effective bankruptcy research. Thanks again, Anton.
Thank you.
It was really good.
Thanks.
The forms just went around on bikes. I think I saved the forms. Somebody asked for that.